From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour is made today, World Parkinson's Day. And with that comes some news. As explained by the University of Rochester Medical Center, the scientific community has debated for decades how Parkinson's disease begins. In 2003, German doctors proposed that it begins outside the brain. In more recent years, a Danish doctor argued that the disease starts in the brain's smell center, referred to as the brain-first model, or the body's intestinal tract, called the body-first model. But a new paper published in the Journal of Parkinson's Disease today unites that those two models along with environmental toxicants that are likely causes of the disease. Those toxins include pesticides, dry cleaning chemicals, tainted food and contaminated water, and air pollution. The paper also explains that different pathways to the brain lead to different forms of this disease. Nearly 1 million Americans are living with Parkinson's disease, and that number is expected to increase in the next few years. According to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, it is the fastest growing neurodegenerative disease. This hour, we will talk to clinicians and nonprofit leaders, a local woman living with the disease, and they're talking about the latest in research and treatment of Parkinson's, including advancements being made here in our region. And I'd like to welcome our guests. Joining me in studio is Yvonne Hilton, a Parkinson's disease patient and board member of the Rochester Parkinson Network. It is always a pleasure to see you. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you. It's so nice to be here with you again.
It's great to have you back with us. Welcome as well. On the line with us is Maggie McGuire-Cool, who is Vice President of Patient Engagement at the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. Maggie, thanks for making time for the program.
Thanks for having me.
Dr. Thomas Cattuso Jr. is with us, professor of neurology and movement disorder neurologist at the University at Buffalo. Dr. Cattuso will join us later. Dr. Ruth Schneider is with us, associate professor in the Department of Neurology, Movement Disorders at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Schneider, thank you for being with us.
Good afternoon, and thank you for having me.
A lot of different places to take this conversation, and I was asking Yvonne off the top. Number one, how you're doing, because some of our listeners have gotten to know you over the years, and I think it's appropriate to start just by asking you how you are generally these days. Can we start there?
Sure. First, thank you for the question. I was diagnosed in 2007, and that's almost 20 years with Parkinson's, and I think I'm doing great. I feel great. I don't suffer a lot of typical symptoms. My balance is my biggest issue. I tend to fall down, and I don't know when that's going to happen, but it makes me more mindful about everything that I do. So in a way, it's a blessing because it's made me slow down. It's made me dissect every action that I take and try to be more efficient about my movements. So I'm thrilled that I'm doing as well as I am, and I'm trying to give back with all I can.
I know that you have been able to do that in multiple ways, Yvonne. First of all, just sharing your story, I think, has moved a lot of our listeners over the years. And some of the board work and the advocacy that you're doing is certainly educating and helping the community. And I think you might have some news to share about something coming up here. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. April 20th, we are having a research forum. Rochester Parkinson Network is bringing together local and super regional experts and researchers who are doing research that people can sign up for and participate in locally. That's what we're all about making connections within the local community for local folks. The event will be at the JCC on Saturday, April 20th. From 1 to 4 p.m.
It's two Saturdays from now, and people can attend?
Oh, yes. It's free to the public. We ask that they register at rockparknet.org and just let us know that you're coming so we can have enough cookies for you.
And so we will have in our show notes when this show posts later today, we'll have a link to that so you can let them know you're coming. The event, though, is free. Coming up here, yes?
Yes, correct.
Okay. How did you pull all of this together?
It was kind of a miracle. We just came up with the idea. We had one of our board members said, I think we should host a national organization. I'll reach out to the Michael J. Fox Foundation, which he did, and they agreed to come visit us. And the notion, I felt very strongly that we wanted to focus in on local research. And I had met Dr. Cattuso a couple of years ago now, I think, and his research fascinated me. And of course, we have the University of Rochester. They're always engaged in lots of cool things. And I have also been working with a doctor from RIT who is offering a Tai Chi program. So there are plenty of opportunities to draw from this wealth of information and resources. And they just happen to all be available and be willing to come in and share their research with us.
Again, that's happening in two Saturdays from now. Maggie McGuire-Cool, who is Vice President of Patient Engagement at the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research. Can you describe a little bit about maybe the importance of events like these for communities like ours and what you're trying to do around the country here, Maggie?
Absolutely. So, you know, partners like Yvonne and the local Rochester Parkinson's Network are really critical partners in driving new treatments and cures. Studies cannot advance without volunteers, and we know that it's a big curve between awareness and education to action to enroll in studies. And so events like the one coming up on April 20th are really key opportunities to be sharing both what's happening in research, how participants are critical to that advancement, and also just have the access and awareness with the specialists, to be able to connect with the community and ask questions and really find what studies are for you.
And Maggie, I want to ask one general question about where we're seeing progress in terms of research. And then I'd like to talk to you and Dr. Schneider about some of the work that's been done to understand what a progression marker might be and what we're learning there. But before we dig into that, let me just ask you, Maggie, if, you know, in these last couple of decades, especially as I mentioned in the introduction, there's been this debate about where Parkinson's really starts. And, you know, we've talked to Dr. Dorsey and many others over the years on this program about concern about a growing body of, I'm going to use the word evidence. I think evidence is the right word about different toxins everywhere from the dry cleaners to environmentally. I don't want to make people flee every store. I mean, I don't have enough information myself. I just bring this up because there's been a mystery to unlock here. And clearly the scientific community has had their own debates about, you know, is it an in-body disease? Is it in brain? Is it primarily from the environment? And do you feel like there has been a coalescing in the scientific community and the research community on this, Maggie, or is there still a lot of debate?
I think that there's a lot of conversation, but there also doesn't need to be a aligned decision. I think that Parkinson's disease, as you know, Yvonne, Dr. Schneider, others who see and live with it every day are aware, is a very heterogeneous disease. And so just like there's a lot of experiences with Parkinson's, there's likely a lot of causes to lead to a disease such as PD. And I think if we look at other conditions such as cancer, you're not treated for a blanket breast cancer or lung cancer anymore. You have a precision therapy that is directed to the biology in your own person. And that is where we are headed with Parkinson's disease. So whether it is a dry cleaning agent or a pesticide or a genetic mutation that causes disease, we're learning a lot about how we may be able to treat a person's individual biology. And that is going to give us the greatest likelihood of success to really be curing and easing this condition.
Dr. Schneider, do you want to add to that?
I will just underscore some of the points that Maggie made. Again, it's a very heterogeneous disease, so everybody's experience with Parkinson's disease is different. And as Maggie was saying, there are different pathways to developing Parkinson's disease, right? And so in most cases, we think it's a combination of environmental risk factors and genetic factors. And so it's very exciting to be, you know, partnering with the Michael J. Fox Foundation and others to be kind of working towards developing precision medicine approaches for folks with Parkinson's disease.
Well, and Yvonne, do you, as a patient living with disease now since 2007 that you were diagnosed, is that right?
Correct.
Okay. Do you spend much time thinking back and trying to unpeel the layers of that, given the fact that the scientific research community has had its own internal debates? Or do you largely say, I can't change it, I'm not going to think too much about what might have caused my condition?
It's interesting because my view has changed somewhat. When I first was diagnosed, I was of the mind that it doesn't matter how I got it. I got it, and I got to figure out how I'm going to move forward with that, you know, with it. But the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease Research has made such great progress. The PPMI project, which we'll probably talk about later, has identified genetic markers that predispose a person to Parkinson's. And I was fortunate enough to participate in that program and found out that I do, in fact, have one of those markers. So it, even though I tried not to perseverate on why I have it, I have some clues, and I grew up drinking well water, downgrading it from a farm. So I could put the pieces together and sort of paint my own picture of how I could have developed Parkinson's. There's nothing I could do to change it, but it makes me realize that we can do things to prevent other generations from getting it, and we should be doing other things. We need to get loud and angry about pesticides, about, you know, toxic chemicals that have been dormant in the environment for a long time. When we know things are a risk to health, we should address them. And it's made me more, I guess, concerned about how I got it, so that we can address the cause and prevent it from happening again to others.
Well, let's talk about it. You heard our guest mention PPMI, the Parkinson's Progression Marker Initiative. And I want to start by asking Dr. Ruth Schneider to describe this, if you could. My understanding is URMC is the study site, and Dr. Schneider has been a lead investigator here. Go ahead, doctor.
That's correct. So PPMI, or the Parkinson's Progression Markers Initiative, is a landmark natural history study that is sponsored by the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Disease Research. It started back in 2010 and has really grown tremendously over the years. So there are, at this point, I believe, more than 50 sites located across the world. As you said, University of Rochester is one site. And my involvement with the study started around 2020. And it's been a great privilege to be involved with it and to help join the PPMI team. And really the aim of the study is to identify new biological, new imaging, new markers of disease, right, of Parkinson's disease, so that we can have a better way to diagnose it, a better way to predict how somebody's symptoms and disease is going to progress, and that we can use what we learn to better design clinical trials and come up with better treatments for Parkinson's disease. You know, as many are aware, we have a great number of symptomatic treatments that are available for managing the different symptoms of Parkinson's disease, but we don't at this time have any medications or therapeutics that slow the progression of the disease, halt it, or reverse it. And so that's really what the research community is strongly working towards. PPMI at this time has thousands of participants. Maggie's going to know the numbers far better than I do. Many of those folks have contributed more than 10 years of their lives to participating in this study. And that's people with Parkinson's disease and people without Parkinson's disease as well. Locally, we have about 40 individuals who are participating in the study and coming into the center for regular visits. And it's hard. There's so many publications that have come out of PPMI. It would be impossible for me to give an overview of that. But, you know, one of the amazing things about PPMI from my perspective is that they make all of their data, all of the de-identified data from the study, available to researchers. So this means that we can just benefit so much more as a community from what the study is doing. And one paper that has come out from the PPMI team recently that has gotten, and deservedly so, a fair amount of attention is looking at a new diagnostic marker for Parkinson's disease. And I'll tell you just a little bit about that and then let Maggie take over. But essentially what this manuscript was on what's called an alpha-synuclein seed amplification assay. And so I'll try to do my best to break that down a bit. So alpha-synuclein is a protein, and in Parkinson's disease, we see misfolding and clumping of this protein. And what this assay can do is it can essentially kind of amplify very small amounts of this abnormal protein so that we can detect it. And in this case, the sample or the fluid that was used is called cerebral spinal fluid, which is fluid that bathes the brain and the spinal cord. And what was exciting about this is that this assay very accurately was able to distinguish between folks with Parkinson's disease and without Parkinson's disease. And it could also detect those who seem to be at higher risk for developing Parkinson's disease. So it's, you know, exciting to think about one day having a tool that we can use in the clinic to help us with diagnosis and also to potentially identify folks who may be at higher risk of developing Parkinson's disease down the road.
Maggie, do you want to pick it up from there? Anything you want to add?
Yeah, again, as Ruth, Dr. Schneider said, really the game-changing discovery of this biological marker is built on the shoulders of the participants like Yvonne and the sites. As she said, University of Rochester has been a longtime partner in the study. It's certainly just the beginning. It's a great start, but we still have a lot of work to do, both to make this test more accessible. As she said, it's currently in spinal fluid. We would love if it was a blood test or a skin test. And we also just have a lot more to learn about this disease. As we were just discussing, there's so much varied biology that leads to Parkinson's. And so the more that we can figure out, the more that we can help answer those questions. Why did I get Parkinson's disease? What's going to happen to me? And more importantly, how can I stop it now so that I don't progress?
Yvonne, you mentioned PPMI. Does this give you a greater sense of optimism than you've had in a while on this?
I honestly, no, Evan.
It doesn't.
I'm 100% certain that the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's disease research is going to crack this. I truly believe that they've committed the resources to, and they continue to commit the resources in a way that will ultimately rid us of this. But I don't think it's going to happen in my lifetime. I've never felt optimistic that I would be seeing a cure. And I hope I'm not sounding
pessimistic.
Yes, thank you.
Okay,
thank you.
No, I don't think so. I think you're sounding realistic.
I just don't think it's too complicated, that notion does not sadden me. It's just my opinion on it.
Okay.
And I don't want to bring down other people.
Well, I don't think, Maggie McGuire, cool. That to me sounds like someone who is very confident in the work that your organization is doing, but also trying to remain realistic and not get ahead of herself. Is that fair, Maggie?
That's absolutely fair. And Yvonne, I don't take any feelings at all to your comments. And what I do take from it is urgency. Mm-hmm. There are millions of people living with Parkinson's today, living with risk factors, and they are waiting. They are watching. And so we really put that at the center of our investments, our programs, and we work forward strategically, smartly, but also as quickly as possible. I will say I've been at Fox for 11 years. Obviously, Dr. Schneider's been with in the medical field for a while as well. Yvonne, you've been living with disease for so long. And you know, when I started, there were a handful of therapies and trials, and we were just starting to understand even something like alpha-synuclein. There was one therapy in trials against alpha-synuclein, the protein that Dr. Schneider outlined. And now there are more than a dozen, and there are more than a dozen different targets that therapies are going after. So while I do think that things are not moving as fast as we know the patient community needs, they are also multiplying in momentum at record speed. And we are, again, really putting the patients and their unmet needs at the center of our work.
We're talking about Parkinson's disease, and it is World Parkinson's Day. There's an event coming up on April 20th, which we'll circle back to soon to make sure you understand what's happening in our own community. And we're talking about the latest in research. And listeners, I see some emails. I'll get to those in a moment. If you've got questions, comments about Parkinson's disease, you can email the program, connections@wxxi.org. You can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255, 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester, 263-9994. Let me also ask Dr. Schneider about the notion of what is a realistic hope for example, the PPMI study and where this might take us. And I'm not asking you to overpromise or overestimate. I'm simply asking that if the data that you're getting is as effective as you hope it is, whether it's in another 5, another 10, another 20 years, what that means for patients and treatment and therapy, realistically, not the maybe the perfect scenario, but what you truly think can be accomplished here, Dr. Schneider.
Well, I'll start by saying I certainly can understand how Yvonne is feeling and kind of appreciate her drive to instill some urgency into the situation, because there is some urgency. I will say that I generally feel optimistic about the state of research in Parkinson's disease. And, you know, I think PPMI is helping us to develop better tools, right, for measuring Parkinson's disease, better ways of identifying the right people to be in clinical trials of different types of interventions. Beyond that, there are a tremendous number of people in the research community who are trying to tackle this problem in different ways and from different directions, right? So Maggie mentioned, you know, some studies that are focusing on the alpha-synuclein protein. That's great. I think that's one promising strategy that exists. But I'll just highlight that there are other researchers who are working on targeting genetic aspects. There are other researchers who are working on using induced pluripotent stem cells. And there are others that are looking at light therapy. And so I think the fact that there are kind of all of these different approaches gives me hope about the state of research in Parkinson's disease. And I will say I do feel some momentum in what's happening in the field right now.
Well, I think you're the person to ask Dr. Schneider Chad's question. He emailed to ask, what are the criteria for diagnosis now for Parkinson's?
The criteria are entirely clinical. So essentially the way we make the diagnosis is by talking to a person, kind of hearing their story, hearing about their symptoms, the problems that they've been experiencing, and then doing an examination. And so we'll look on the examination for things like tremor or shaking of the hands. We'll look for bradykinesia, which is a slowness and loss of coordination of movements. We'll look for stiffness. We'll look for changes in your walking. And that's how we make the diagnosis. We might ask some other questions to kind of rule out other possibilities. Sometimes we'll get an imaging study like a head MRI in order to rule out other possibilities. But we don't have anything right now that can definitively say, yes, you have Parkinson's disease.
Okay. Maggie, is there anything that you want to add about what your organization has seen with diagnosis. I think people are curious about diagnosis rates and just in general, some of the numbers we share about how many people we know have Parkinson's, if that's changed, if we are seeing more prevalence or if we're just seeing more diagnosis, et cetera.
Yeah, so I think you said in your intro that there's the World Health Organization estimates around 6.5 million, and that number is supposed to double by 2040. The reason why is likely a combination of folks living longer. There is perhaps more recognition of the disease, and so there are higher diagnosis rates, but we know there's still a large access to care issue, especially around populations traditionally underrepresented in research. And I want to say, too, about the diagnosis and to build on what Dr. Schneider was saying, you know, right now you are often at a lengthy time to diagnosis. You might see a couple physicians, you might be referred to a specialist such as she, and then you have this subjective clinical diagnosis. Studies like PPMI are trying to make that more objective and intervene earlier. So one of the fascinating things that we've learned in part through PPMI is that there are some clinical factors that can predispose or precede a Parkinson's diagnosis. One of those is smell loss. Interestingly, I know many of us perhaps experienced temporary smell loss during the pandemic, and more enduring smell loss is a sign of early Parkinson's risk potentially. And so the PPMI study offers a free scratch and sniff smell test that will send to your home. It's 40 questions. You sort of get to have a little fun scratching and sniffing and seeing, you know, is this wine, chocolate, mint, et cetera. And then if you do show significant smell loss, we'll invite you for additional screening and maybe you'd go visit Dr. Schneider at U of R, one of our other clinical sites. So we're learning more about those early signs so that we can drive people to diagnosis more clearly and earlier so that, again, hopefully we can intervene more earlier.
And you're asking anyone age 60 or older to take that free scratch and sniff smell test, is that right?
That's right. Currently 60 and without Parkinson's disease, and anyone can go learn more about the test and around the PPMI study on our site, michaeljfox.org/PPMI. The other risk factor, in case it resonates with any listeners, is people who act out their dreams while they're asleep. You might punch or kick or hit. Perhaps you're a bed partner who has recognized that in someone that you sleep with. So that and smell loss are really the big risk factors. But yes, anyone over age 60 can visit michaeljfox.org/PPMI and learn more about the study.
Maggie, I'm 44. I don't know if I'm too young on the last part of this, but when I was 27, I dove down a flight of stairs in the middle of the night when I was sleeping. And then the next night, I got out the front door and was running until my feet started bleeding. And when I woke up in the middle of 31F near a Wegmans, I don't know if I don't know what that means for. I mean, I've seen specialists over the years. It's pretty similar to what listeners have heard from Mike Birbiglia, the comedian. He and I share that same kind of thing. I don't know if my age means it's not pertinent to what you're doing, or if that's the kind of stuff that you're interested in.
So first of all, I love Mike Birbiglia as a comedian and as a friend of our foundation. He made a video about this sleep disorder and it's linked to Parkinson's disease that you can also watch.
I didn't know that part of it. Okay.
I'll send you a link after our call today. But yes, through PPMI, we're learning more about the connection between that sleep disorder and Parkinson's. Again, I'm sure Dr. Schneider would have some to add. But we are looking for people who are at more likelihood of developing Parkinson's in the near future so that we can understand what those biological changes look like from something like the sleep disorder to the Parkinson's motor symptoms and where the best time to intervene is. So while right now you might be a little bit young for PPMI, in the future, you know, perhaps by the time you would be eligible, we'll have an intervention if you perchance would have that biology.
Dr. Schneider, you want to add to that?
I just might make a clarification that there are different types of parasomnias, which are different types of behaviors that you can see when folks are sleeping. And, you know, specifically what Maggie is referencing is called REM sleep behavior disorder. So yeah, it's when you act out your dreams in this particular stage of your sleep. Other things like sleepwalking tend to happen in other stages of sleep. So I don't know if that reassures you at all, Evan.
The show is not about me. I'm hoping that my questions might trigger somebody else who's gone through something similar. I know it's not a big category, but it's interesting to start to make connections on how you know, what the brain is telling us or why certain things are happening. And so, again, I want to stress two points here. It's michaeljfox.org/PPMI. If you want to do the free scratch and sniff smell test, your age 60 or older, you can learn information there. We'll have it in our show notes when we post later today as well. And Dr. Schneider, is there anything else that you want listeners to understand about URMC as a study site and what you need?
Oh, well, one, just a thank you to Yvonne and the Rochester Parkinson's Network for putting on this great event and for the Michael J. Fox Foundation for joining it. We're very excited to be part of it. We'll talk about PPMI. We'll talk about some other studies that we're doing and kind of how folks with and without Parkinson's disease can contribute to that research. I might take a moment just to highlight one of those. We're doing another study that's called Activate. This is a clinical trial that's looking at a treatment for individuals with a genetic form of Parkinson's disease. So we've kind of mentioned before that in most cases, we think Parkinson's disease is due to a combination of environmental and genetic risk factors. And about 10% of people with Parkinson's disease, we think have more of a genetic form of Parkinson's disease. And there's been a number of different genes that have been associated with it. The most common genetic risk factor is something called GBA1 or glucocerebrosidase 1. And so this study, Activate, is looking at a drug that activates an enzyme that is relative to folks who have this GBA variant. And so I think this just highlights the potential again for targeted precision medicine therapeutics, right? It's kind of recognizing that there are different causes for Parkinson's disease, and I don't think there's going to be one magic cure-all solution. Rather, we're going to need different targeted approaches for everyone, for different individuals. And then secondly, I'll just say we do have a research interest log, a registry, that's the word I'm looking for.
Yep.
It's called Project Brain. So if anybody wants to go to projectbrain.org, you can sign up to hear about research studies that we're doing at the University of Rochester.
Let me squeeze in a few listener questions here that have come by email. Actually, this is a text to the show, so I only have a phone number that I'm not going to read. I don't have a name, but the question is this. Are there any new research developments in the treatment of progressive supranuclear palsy? That is not one I'm familiar with. Dr. Schneider?
So progressive supranuclear palsy, or PSP, is a form of atypical Parkinsonism. So while there is some overlap between the symptoms of progressive supranuclear palsy and Parkinson's disease, it is a different disorder with different underlying biology. And rather than the synuclein protein that we know is affected in Parkinson's disease in PSP, it's the tau protein. So the short answer is no, nothing that I am aware of recently has come out for delaying or slowing the progression of PSP. It is a much rarer disorder than Parkinson's disease, which creates some additional challenges to studying it and developing treatments. I would refer the messenger perhaps to clinicaltrials.gov, which is always a great resource. You're looking for kind of active ongoing research studies.
Let me also mention that WXXI recently aired Independent Lens, Matter of the Mind, My Parkinson's. We screened it last month at the Little, and it is now available to watch for free on demand through May 8th. We will link to it in our show notes when we put the audio up for this program at wxxinews.org/connections, where you'll find the audio of every show we do, or wherever your podcasts are not sold, hopefully free. So that's where you can find Independent Lens, Matter of the Mind, My Parkinson's. Just one other note from a listener that I want to make sure I ask Maggie about before we let Maggie go. And this is one that always makes me, I admit, Maggie, a little bit uncomfortable, but we're an open forum. We're airing questions from listeners. So the caveat here is these are just, I think, direct comments and questions. I'm not endorsing, the show is not endorsing any specific products or items produced by commercial outlets. And no one is saying that I'm certainly not saying they cause Parkinson's, but people are, I think, nervous. People are starting to think through their choices. And this is what Dallas writes. Dallas says he heard Lunchables have lead. He heard Windex changed their formula, so he stopped using it. And he says, I pretty much clean everything in my house with vinegar, lemon juice, Dawn dish soap, and Castile soap, and sometimes Murphy wood soap too. That's from Dallas. I think that represents, Maggie, whether those concerns are supported by evidence or not, people are, I think there should be an appropriate interest that people have. I don't want people to panic, whether it's washing your fruit, whether it's thinking about different agents in your home or what you're cleaning your clothes or house with. But do you want to weigh in a little bit on how people are starting to think about these items in their sort of in their lives and what maybe we should be thinking about?
Yeah, so where my mind goes with a question like that is that we do need more data to bring it back to our earlier conversation around environmental factors and why people get Parkinson's disease. So in addition to funding and driving a lot of biomedical research, our foundation is also very active in advocacy and policy operations. And so we have an arm that is working with government agencies and academics and others interested in this field to be collecting data, be it through state registries or looking at available data sets from health records to understand where are there sort of clusters or patterns in Parkinson's disease and what do we know about perhaps what's in the environment there. I don't think we would drill down into what household cleaners folks are using, but I do think that there's a lot of room to be looking at broader trends and not to be waiting for really definitive findings around that. For example, the EPA has proposed a ban on TCE, which is a chemical that's used in dry cleaning and other products. And so I do think that there's already a lot of momentum in trying to limit access or exposure to agents that we know already, definitively know cause a rise in Parkinson's risk. And we're also looking at ways, again, be it through state registries or other data sets, to understand who's getting Parkinson's and what are the trends among those individuals and how can we be intervening, be it with policy or pharmacological interventions or lifestyle recommendations, et cetera.
I want to thank Maggie McGuire-Cool, Vice President of Patient Engagement at the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's Research, for the time and certainly for the effort and the interest in communities like ours. Thank you, Maggie. We always appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. It was lovely to chat.
And the website there, the general website for the research there, michaeljfox.org, and then we'll link you to PPMI and how you can find that there. So michaeljfox.org and michaeljfox.org/PPMI. Let's do this. Let's take our only break of the hour here. We're going to do this a little late, and in a moment we're going to bring in Dr. Thomas Cattuso Jr., who is going to join us and join the conversation with Dr. Ruth Schneider, who's with us. Yvonne Hilton is here, a Parkinson's, not only someone who's been talking about her diagnosis that happened in 2007 and her life since, but also a board member for the Rochester Parkinson Network. It's World Parkinson's Day, and we're right back with them on Connections. Coming up in our second hour, there have been really numerous, uncountable really, headlines about how climate change is connected to inequality, injustice, often racism, but how exactly and what can be done about it. The Climate Solutions Accelerator's annual summit is next weekend in Rochester. We're going to talk to some of their speakers, and we're going to talk about how they are focusing this year's summit next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Right before the break, we read an email from Dallas, who was concerned about products in his house and thinking about changes that he has made because of concerns. And again, I want to just stress again, you heard Maggie McGuire-Cool from the Michael J. Fox Foundation say, we need more data. No one is sitting here saying, don't buy this product or throw this out. But people are more aware. They're more concerned. And I know Yvonne wanted to kind of weigh in on that too. Go ahead, Yvonne.
I say, Dallas, rah, rah, rah for what you're doing, and don't wait for someone or some agency or group to tell you what is safe and what to steer away from. Follow your instincts, read labels, do what makes sense. the fewer ingredients, the better. The more quote unquote natural we can be, the vinegars, the baking soda, the products that you mentioned are all safe and they're more positive choices. And the more positive choices we can make, the better off we'll be. Not to, trying to steer away from weaning ourselves off dry cleaning, for example, not using pesticides on our lawns. Mm-hmm. There are just a myriad of ways that, but you know, buying organic and eating organic to the extent it's possible for you, that it's accessible and meets your budget. These are all things that we need to advocate for ourselves, and we need to take a stand and support the things that we know are feed our wellness.
Well, that's some of what was on your mind when you helped put together this event coming up in two Saturdays from now, April 20th, if you're just joining us. It's happening. Where is it happening, Yvonne?
At the JCC on 1200 Edgewood Avenue.
At the JCC on Saturday, April 20th. Remind people what they can experience if they want to come out for this event.
It's a research forum, and we'll be providing information on research that you can sign up for, you can participate in. These are all projects that people with Parkinson's can participate in, and it helps them live their best life now. They're not cures, but they're things that we can do with Parkinson's to help alleviate symptoms that are possibly slow progression. One is an opportunity to sign up for Rocksteady Boxing, which will be a free opportunity because it's a study. And Rocksteady Boxing has been shown to be a great benefit for folks. RIT will be sponsoring a Tai Chi class. Tai Chi helps improve balance for people with Parkinson's. University of Rochester will be presenting a light therapy that, again, will focus on, it's a non-invasive form of treatment for Parkinson's. Apologize, my voice is
You're doing great.
Getting crackly, but, and finally, Dr. Caduso from University of Buffalo will be talking about the use of lithium to address Parkinson's symptoms.
Well, he's here now, so let's let Dr. Caduso jump in here. Dr. Thomas Caduso is professor of neurology and movement disorder, a movement disorder neurologist at the University of Buffalo. And the book is called The Promise of Lithium. You can find it at promiseoflithium.com. You just heard Yvonne mention it. Dr. Caduso, thank you for making time.
Yeah, great to be here.
You want to tell us a little bit about some of how The Promise of Lithium came to be and what you observed and why it ended up in a book?
Sure. I became interested in lithium probably about 8-9 years ago. It was completely by accident. I really had no interest in lithium at all. As a neurologist, lithium is used to treat a psychiatric condition called bipolar disorder. I became interested in it when a patient of mine with Parkinson's, who also happened to have this psychiatric condition called bipolar disorder, his psychiatrist put him on a very low dose of lithium, and he then informed me that a lot of his Parkinson's symptoms, one in particular called motor fluctuations, improved greatly, and was just wondering if maybe it could be from the lithium. That kind of started my interest in it, was this symptomatic benefit in this one patient anecdotally. And I started using it in some of my other patients after reading a little bit more about it and seeing there had been some work done at Duke Medical Center way back in the early 1980s. And was impressed with its anecdotal benefit for motor fluctuations. But just from reading all about lithium, I realized that there was a potential much greater benefit for Parkinson's patients than improving motor fluctuations. And that was as a possible disease-modifying agent, a way to protect brain cells, slow down the progressive brain cell death that occurs in Parkinson's, and slow down the progressive worsening of symptoms over time. So that's really the focus of our research now is on lithium, low-dose lithium therapy as a possible disease-modifying agent, a way to slow down the progression of the disease.
And why haven't you been able to attract more investment for this interest?
Yes, good question. I don't think I have a good answer for you. I think it's multiple reasons. One big reason is that lithium is a very old medication. There's no chance for a patent protection. So really the private industries, like pharmaceutical companies, are not going to be interested in developing lithium because there really is no way to recoup the investment costs. I've had challenges trying to get funding from the government, from the NIH, as well as from private foundations. And I think it's probably a bunch of reasons, actually, that I cover in the book, which you mentioned. It's actually available on Amazon. I think one big reason is it just sounds like a ludicrous idea to think that people take lithium. It's just a medicine for bipolar disorder. Why in the world would this work for patients with Parkinson's? Another thing that anybody who's familiar with potential side effects of lithium, when lithium is used in the higher doses necessary to treat bipolar disorder, one of the most common side effects is tremor. And people will think, well, patients with Parkinson's, a lot of them already have tremor. Why would you want to give them a medicine that could cause tremor? But at low doses, it doesn't cause that type of a side effect. So I think there's just a lot of barriers to people believing that lithium could potentially have this benefit. I think another reason is people just think it's too simple. It's just way too simple of an idea. You know, the diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's disease, which is another potential application of lithium, you know, are felt to be very complicated diseases in terms of what's causing them, and how could something as simple as a very low dose of lithium, which is actually an all-natural element, it's part of our environment. Lithium itself is over 13 billion years old. It came into an existence at the same time the universe came into existence. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's in the food we eat, it's in the water we drink. We're exposed to lithium every day. So, it has been frustrating, but fortunately, the research that we've been doing, we have had some positive results, for, you know, preliminary in a small number of patients, but, you know, potentially exciting. And so we have been able to get funding from a couple different organizations to keep our research moving forward.
Well, again, more information at promiseoflithium.com. Let me squeeze in another listener question before the hour's up. Catherine says, Parkinson's can include Lewy bodies dementia? And she says, my grandmother had Parkinson's disease. My mother was a caregiver for her at regular intervals. My mother had Lewy bodies dementia in her elderly years. Could she have acquired it by being around her mother-in-law with Parkinson's? Dr. Schneider, do you want to answer that one?
Yeah, sure. Partly this is a terminology question, right? So we had talked a little bit before about how we see the clumps of the alpha-synuclein, clumps of this abnormal protein. When we see those, we call them Lewy bodies. So dementia or Lewy body dementia refers to somebody who has those Lewy bodies and dementia. And that can really refer to two different conditions, either Parkinson's disease with dementia or a related condition called dementia with Lewy bodies. So the wording, the terminology gets a bit confusing there.
Okay. And anything to add there, Dr. Cattuso?
No, that's completely.
Full endorsement. There you go. This has been the kind of hour, I mean, these questions are far and wide, but part of the reason is, Yvonne and I have talked about over the years, is people are still confused about why diseases happen and want to learn more, and they start kind of connecting dots, and sometimes that's very appropriate to do so, and sometimes it may be a natural reaction but maybe not related. So for you, Yvonne, final thoughts from you for the audience as you get ready for April 20th, two Saturdays from now. What do you want to leave with listeners?
Today is Parkinson's Awareness Day, and our whole We're so grateful to be here to spread the word that Parkinson's is still with us. It's over 100-year-old disease, and we're still using roughly 100-year-old medications to treat it. We need to ramp up understanding of the whole community of what it is and what causes it, so we can get rid of it.
Well, anything that you heard this hour that involves the studies that are going on, the Michael J. Fox Foundation, we'll have in our show notes, and there's a lot of opportunities for people to participate in some of this ongoing research. I want to thank Dr. Ruth Schneider, Associate Professor in the Department of Neurology, Movement Disorders at the University of Rochester Medical Center. Dr. Schneider, thank you for your expertise this hour.
Thank you so much for having me.
Our thanks to Dr. Thomas Cattuso, Jr., Professor of Neurology and a Movement Disordered Neurologist at the University at Buffalo. Dr. Cattuso, thank you for joining the program.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
And Ms. Hilton, it is always lovely to see you. You're an inspiration to so many. And that's not, I don't use that term lightly. I'm just so impressed at your advocacy and how hard you've pushed us to better understand this. And I want to thank you for that. So please keep coming back if you want to.
Thank you. I'd love to.
And sharing your story and the work. April 20th is coming up here at the JCC. Full information in our show notes. They would love to see you there on April 20th. More connections coming up in just a moment.